I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. On this edition of Parallax Views, we revisit the topic of the pandemic as economic crisis with returning guest and veteran journalist Albert Lanier. On March 23rd, Albert joined us to discuss this very topic, and I decided, in light of recent events, such as former Amazon employee Chris Smalls' fight for workers' rights, an Amazon facility in Staten Island, that it would be a good time to have Lanier on to revisit the topic of the pandemic as an economic crisis. What we are seeing right now are strikes, both work and rent related, occurring across the United States of America. What does it all mean? Well, that's what I sought to answer on this edition of Parallax Views. As usual, we are joined by my co-host Casey and special guest Albert Lanier. And with that being said, let's jump right into the conversation. Welcome back to Parallax Views. Albert Lanier, our sort of veteran journalist correspondent. How are you doing, Albert? Last time we had you on was just a few short weeks ago when this coronavirus thing was just picking up. Now it's right. Even, you know, more crazy than it was then. Ooh.
Yeah, it's gone from a sort of epidemic to a pandemic to what I at the time predicted would be an economic crisis. And I believe the other predictions, what few I had, were that it would fit the normal patterns. And we've seen those patterns happen. So, which includes a response from Congress, the so-called CARES Act, bailout bill. And so a little of that's come true. But we're still in sort of uncharted waters in regards to this crisis. So we really don't know what's going to happen.
So it's interesting. This conversation that we're having right now is going to be part of an episode that I also just conducted, a conversation I just conducted with Chris Smalls. I'm going to have both interviews in one episode. You were the one that alerted me to Chris Smalls, actually, and his fight for workers' rights in Amazon. We don't have to talk about Chris Smalls necessarily directly, but we can talk about workers' rights, I guess, and the role that's playing in everything right now. Well, what do you make of it, Albert?
Well, as I mentioned in the previous episode of Parallax Views, at the time when the pandemic was really just beginning to gather steam in the United States in terms of closures of businesses and closures of institutions and cancellations of events and sports leagues like the NBA and Major League Baseball and other types of live events, and just across the board, what you've seen is an impact. At the time that I mentioned that it was a health crisis tethered to an economic crisis. And so what we're seeing now is the larger economic crisis unfolding. We're going from a recession at present, I would argue, to a depression. I would call it the Great Depression 2.0. And commensurate with that, what we're seeing in the U.S. especially, what we're seeing are the sort of aspects of this crisis unfurl, you know, in regards to how, to put it mildly, the bottom 90% are reacting compared to the top 10%. And so that bottom 90%, as I term it, are beginning to react in ways to try to ameliorate their situation, because their situation is a closure of businesses, especially businesses that are like restaurants and other sort of very labor-intensive industries. These workers are staying at home. They're not getting paychecks. And what money they have in savings or what money they have that they just got maybe a paycheck before they had to, before they got laid off or before they had to leave, has probably run out. And so what's happened is that all the commensurate expenses that are related to everyday living, you know, bills, rent, food, and other incidentals, these have to be taken care of in some way. And you can't do it because you can't rely on the paycheck. Paycheck is history. So what do these workers do? They do what I think workers have done throughout all of American history. They rise up. They start going on strikes. You saw it with the company Instacart. You saw it with Whole Foods. And you saw it with Amazon, which is why Chris Smalls himself became famous for his leading a walkout at the Amazon facility there in New York. So that's what you're seeing on the part of employees. Something that's striking is in California, McDonald's workers in that state are staging protests. They're staging protests over the fact that they lack what is known as PPE, which is personal protective equipment.
Can I interject really quickly here? I wanted to let you know, here in Pittsburgh, at least within the city limits of Pittsburgh, the sanitation workers have went on strike and protested because they want PPE. So it's happening all around the country.
Well, again, in terms of fast food, I'm looking at that one instance in California with McDonald's workers. But as I mentioned previously, it's workers across the country. So you see workers, whether it is Amazon, Whole Foods, Instacart, in this case, McDonald's in California, across the country, you're seeing workers strike. And not only workers strike, but even just everyday individuals striking as well. They're doing rent strikes in places like California and others, because again, as I mentioned, with jobs having been shut down, because businesses have been shut down and paychecks not coming in, people can't pay rent. And that has become crucial, and it's become critical, because the lack of monies lead to the lack of everyday expenses like rent. So they're not able to pay rent. The old expression goes, the rent can't wait. Well, in this case, with the economy as it is, the rent will have to wait. But this is becoming a major issue. And so we're seeing the kind of daisy chain of the economy. We're seeing this sort of almost like a water flow in terms of financial water flow, you know, of how things are connected. The lack of jobs, lack of paychecks, which means lack of money for everyday expenses and for other kinds of expenses. There's a connectedness in this economy. I don't just mean a very basic connectedness. I mean the way that the U.S. economy is structured, and in some parts of the world, other countries, it's a consumerist economy, which is why a lot of these companies and a lot of these businesses have shut down. So there's a connectedness that has been severed. And so what we're seeing is we've moved into a recession, which is fast becoming a depression. I would call it Great Depression 2.0. And so for the 90%, for the people who are the majority of this country, and for workers and employees in general, they've had, in many respects, and some specific aspects, to rise up, to strike, to fight for their rights, because nobody else is going to be fighting for their rights.
I wanted to add to that. I mean, we can quibble over what percentage of the population this is. I've often used the term the 20%, and sort of the upper middle class, the people that are probably most likely to be able to work from home right now. But it's interesting, a lot of those people, whether we call them the 20 or the 10%, whatever, those people are saying, we need to open up the economy back up. We just need to do it right now. And it's funny because I've noticed those are the people that are able to work from home. And I'm thinking to myself, I wonder if they know on some visceral, intuitive level that when this is all said and done, a lot of the jobs they have are going to be hit next. People that work at courthouses, teachers that are able to work from home, funding will be cut for a lot of institutions after this is all said and done. And I almost feel like there's this almost a willingness to sacrifice the working class, open up the economy just so a lot of other people can save their own ass.
Well, one of the things that I noted in the previous interview was that what you're seeing in this economy is the cleavage between those who work at home and those who work outside the home. And this has become extremely stark and dramatic. So one of the things I pointed out was that the American economy does not work for workers and for most people. I pointed this out on the other program. We're now seeing this in really, really dramatic ways, and it's getting worse and worse by the day. Now, what's interesting is that Annie Lowry, a writer for The Atlantic, noted in an article in August of 2019 that the economy, this was prior to, of course, the coronavirus crisis, and what I call the ensuing economic crisis that has come with it. She noted that the U.S. economy, in many respects, is a decade of lost wages. That is, in many respects, kind of the worst job market in over 80 years. And she makes a point that I have made, which is that people are making less money, the millennials, the ensuing generations, are making less money than baby boomers. Despite the fact that this economy is ostensibly better, I noted in my previous interview that we have a low-wage, high-profit economy. Thus, profits were up. Thus, revenues were up. Thus, all kinds of indices, like the stock market, like other kinds of markets, were up in regards to the economy prior to the coronavirus outbreak in the U.S. and, of course, worldwide. But what was bad was that wages weren't keeping up with profits. They weren't keeping up with stock prices. They weren't keeping up with bond prices. They weren't keeping up in general. They weren't. So the problem is that we had this low-wage, high-profit economy. It was an economy that worked for the top 10% and didn't work for the lower 90%. And so what Lowry notes is, as I mentioned, that what's happened is that this job market hasn't been great because what we've had are low-wage jobs, essentially. As I mentioned in my previous interview, I mentioned it's become a reductive economy, which is that we've ended up having retail jobs and like Amazon, you know, like Walmart, for example, and those that are close to retail, online, like Amazon. What we've had is service economy jobs that have dominated the economy in the United States. And so what that has resulted in are lower wages. And in fact, in many respects, not living wages. So people are doing Uber and Lyft not because they like taking their car and picking up people to drive them to wherever they need to go, but because they need to make money, because this money will help offset whatever other job they have or whatever other profession, if they have a, still have a profession that they are practicing. We live in a, this, thus it's a reductive economy, as opposed to what it had been before. I would argue it was a productive economy, where you had manufacturing jobs, where you had factory jobs that could pay close to living wages, and where people who had relatively modest educations, like a high school diploma, could go and work in factories, and they could afford to buy cars, they could afford to buy homes, afford to have families, and send their kids to college. And college prices were also a lot cheaper, not only for private colleges, but public colleges as well. So what we see now is in student debt, which has become a big issue in regards to colleges. What we see are higher cost of living. So people can't afford to buy homes. They can barely afford to have cars. They certainly can't afford to send their kids to college. So this is the kind of economy that we had prior to the coronavirus outbreak. It seemed very good. It seemed great, but it was great for owners and investors, not for workers and employees. Now, Lowry also wrote an article in February of 2020 for The Atlantic. And what she notes is how, admittedly, in one of the best decades of the American economy, this is a quote, in one of the best decades of the American economy ever recorded, families were bled dry by landlords, hospital administrators, university bursars, and child care centers. Again, we see how the economy hasn't worked for working people and has worked for owners and investors, not workers and employees. What Lowry notes is, for millions, a roaring economy felt precarious or downright terrible. And now this economy is neither precarious, is not precarious per se, but it is downright terrible. We're past the point of precariousness. We're at the point of absolute horror and terror because things are getting so bad. And you have an administration that wants to, quote, open America up, as if America is one gigantic business, as if it's just one big store or one big restaurant or one big factory or warehouse. That is the administration's view of America. And that's how they're viewing this crisis. They're not viewing it purely as a health crisis. They're viewing it as an economic crisis that is costing most of the business community, but not all the business community. Corporations like Amazon are doing quite well. They're making millions of dollars because people are going online and clicking. They're ordering. And so, again, as I noted with Annie Lowry's two articles, one from 2019 and the other from this year, 2020, this economy doesn't work. And she notes what I have noted, and she bears out what I have been noting in my last interview and elsewhere, and that is this economy has been really terrible for most average Americans, for most average workers, for most average employees.
I would disagree with you. I mean, this economy works for certain people. It works for a very small percentage of people. It just doesn't work for the rest.
That's my point.
Right. Okay,
well,
I see.
Again, you have to understand, it does work, but it works for the top 10%. Not only I noted that in my previous interview with Parallax Views, but I note it now. And it's evident that it works. It's clear that it works. That is why workers are rising up, because they're going to McDonald's to work and considered essential employees. But they're not getting essential pay. They're not even being equipped with essential equipment. So they're going out and working at McDonald's. They're working at Amazon. They're working for Instacart. They're working at Whole Foods. They're essential workers, but they don't have essential equipment. And they sure as hell don't have essential pay. Maybe at best Amazon will pay $2 a bit more an hour or something like that. But that's not enough. If these workers are going to face the hazards of possible disease, and of course with that possible death, then they should get hazard pay. But they're taking hazards without getting hazard pay.
I agree 110% with what you're saying. It's interesting. I've had people say to me, oh, you know, the Trump administration is handling this so stupidly. Why are they handling this so stupidly? I have friends that work at Walmart. What about them? And I'm like, you don't understand. This is by design, essentially. I mean, this is an economy that is willing to sacrifice certain people, put them in a giant wicker man, and let them burn. That is sort of where we are at with the current administration and with the way things have been going for the past at least 40 years. I think of, if I could real quick, I'm sure both of you are familiar with the comedian Bill Hicks, correct?
That's right, I am.
So I want to quote this real quick, because it's a Bill Hicks quote that I've been thinking about a lot lately. And Bill Hicks said, "They don't want the voice of reason spoken, folks, because otherwise we'd be free, and otherwise we wouldn't believe their fucking horseshit lies, nor the fucking propaganda machine, the mainstream media, and buy their horseshit products that we don't fucking need and become a third world consumer fucking plantation, which is what we're becoming. Fuck them. They are liars and murderers." And I know that's really harsh, and I know that Bill Hicks is like probably going a little bit over the top when he said that, but I think in a lot of ways he's right. We've become a system that is willing to basically kill people so that a small percentage of the population can keep their comfort.
Well, here's what you have to understand. Bill Hicks is right, but it's not becoming a third world plantation. It is a third world plantation. The United States, especially in the 21st century, has become a third world society with a first world economy. So it is actually a contradiction. And we're seeing that in the larger society. We're seeing social anomy. We're seeing decay. We're seeing what's going on in regards to the economic disintegration. It's not just the coronavirus economy, if you want to call it that. It is the fact that this economy didn't work before the coronavirus, and it didn't work for most people. But it's not even just that. It is the fact that the U.S. economically, fiscally, financially, is what I would call financial obsolescence. It's economic obsolescence. That means, like planned obsolescence for a product, it's meant to be built and structured to fail. In the larger economy, this is what is known as the business cycle. It is the booms and busts that occur. The way that capitalism is structured in the United States is that it is engineered to fail fiscally and financially. You have to have a stock market crash every so many years, whether it's 1929 or 1987. You have to have recessions and depression, whether it's a recession in the 30s, whether it's the Great Depression in the 30s, whether it's the Great Recession in 2008. This is the way the United States economy and some other economies are structured. The U.S. economy is engineered to fail, but it is not engineered to fail for the bottom 90%. It is not engineered to fail for the top 10%. The United States economy is engineered to fail for the bottom 90%. They are the ones that are left out of the feast, so to speak.
They're given the famine. It's feast or famine, and the people who get the feast are that 10%. People who get famine are the 90% at the bottom.
So let's look at that point, feast or famine. Let's use the sort of visual metaphor, or visual in one's mind, of sort of a dinner party. You have a dinner party at some public institution. You know, they rent out various parks, or they rent out various tourist attractions. They have parties, people do. And so let's just say that you have an event, a party, And of course, those who are invited to the party get to go. And there's a great, great, as you may have noted, feast. All kinds of food there. Outside of this party, which is, say, held in a public tourist destination, you have people out on the street. Homeless, perhaps. Are those homeless people invited to the party? No. In fact, if they even thought about trying to get in, they would be kicked out. That is the kind of situation we have in this country. We have those few that get to go to this party and enjoy themselves, eat to their fill, drink their fill, and enjoy themselves. And you have people outside of this, of the gates, outside onto the street, that have little to no resources, that have to basically do the best job they can to find food, to find resources, and hunker down wherever they are, whether they're living in a tent or living in a sleeping bag. That's basically what America has become. This may seem like a very stark metaphor to make and a very stark example to cite and a sort of stark illustration of sorts, but it's indicative of what this country has become. And it's what has happened, and it's happening in front of our eyes. And people can't ignore it anymore. The people in the top 10% can't do it, and the people in the bottom 90% can't do it. And this is what has happened.
It's interesting.
And so,
I was just going to say, it's interesting you bring up the homeless situation. I mean, we have states like New Orleans all of a sudden saying, oh, we're going to clear out the hotels. We have to get the homeless in there. And, you know, this could have been done prior. We could have found ways to house the homeless before this crisis, but because a bunch of very rich people are worried that they could get this virus now we're going to help the homeless when we should have been doing it before. We should have been doing it regardless, in my opinion, if we were a more ethically guided country. We aren't, though, in so many words. The thing about
Because we are a financially guided country. Again, here's what you have to understand, and those listening have to understand. We are in a country that is financially obsolescent. It is economic obsolescence at work. It's an economy that is engineered to fail the majority of people in this nation. So the bottom 90% have to fend for themselves. The top 10% get all the rewards. As I've often said online, the rich prosper, the poor suffer. The rich prosper, the poor suffer. So this is an economy that is engineered to fail. It is engineered by its very nature. It is the inherent economic obsolescence and financial obsolescence of the United States. This is what people have to understand. So when you discuss the homeless, you have situations in the U.S. where hotels are putting on light displays, empty hotels, vacant hotels, you know, towers. We're not talking about small little motels, but towers that are putting on light displays. You know, they're turning on lights in the room, and they're making like these heart displays in order to thank doctors and to thank nurses and other healthcare workers. I mean, it's a nice gesture, but these empty hotel rooms could have been filled with homeless people who need shelter, need a place to live. And so this is indicative of the planned obsolescence economy, the economic obsolescent economy of the U.S. This tells you a lot. Empty hotels, light displays, get homeless on the ground, in streets in some cities that don't have anywhere to go and nowhere to lay their head. This is America in 2020.
I would argue this is America for, you know, at least 20 years. But
well, again,
go on,
you have to listen to what I stated before. What I stated before is this economy did not work prior to the coronavirus crisis. This has been going on. I mentioned this in my previous interview. This has been going on for more than 40 years. Let me just take this back. In 1971, what you had was the Lewis Powell memo to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And this sort of worked as a blueprint to the business community in telling them, look, you guys got to react against the civil rights movement, against all these other popular movements, women's rights movement, anti-war movement, all these other movements. You've got to use your money and your resources to take over the political arena, to take over the media, and to take over education, if possible. And this provided the blueprint for an activist business community. What became the Business Roundtable, what was the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and remains so, and all these other business groups that have been funneling money into political action committees, that have been funneling money into corporate think tanks, like the American Enterprise Institute, like the Cato Institute, and other kinds of right-wing think tanks, which of course produce so-called studies and reports which are sent to the media and have an influence.
They also produce...
And
I just wanted to say real quick, places like American Enterprise Institute, they get to produce people like Charles Murray, who these clowns like Sam Harris want to convince me are, there's these people like Sam Harris that say that, oh, Charles Murray, Mr. Bell Curve, Mr. Race and IQ, he's being discriminated against. He's had his life ruined for writing this Bell Curve book. Meanwhile, he still has a job at AEI. He's not living out of a cardboard box. He's not living out of a car like some of my friends in Los Angeles who are having to work gig economy jobs and are out of a job now because of this fucking coronavirus crisis. It's beyond me how people just refuse to look at the what you're looking at. You're at least addressing the problem head on.
Right. At this point, people are forced to. But getting back to what I was noting, you just noted an example, Charles Murray, who was the author of the Bell Curve. He's indicative of what you're seeing trotted out. So these think tanks are funded by the business community and the corporate class. And you have individuals like Charles Murray and others with the Cato Institute, American Enterprise Institute. I think Arthur Brooks is another one who was, I think, the head of American Enterprise Institute. And they're interviewed by newspapers, by magazines, by television stations. So this money from the corporate class goes to political action committees, which go to politicians. You have the think tanks that are financed by these corporations. You have corporate money that has virtually taken over this country. And two other factors in the larger economy that I want to look at. You had this corporate capture of the economy and of this country. I would also look at what's changed the economy. In 1971, the same year as the Lewis Powell memo to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, you also have Richard Nixon taking the United States off the post-war Bretton Woods system, where the U.S. currency became the world's de facto currency because it was tied to gold. And other countries could thus, I believe, get gold, I think with U.S. dollars, if I may be misstating that. But the U.S. was tied to gold, and Nixon took the U.S. off the gold standard, and the U.S. took the U.S. away from the Bretton Woods system. What also happened in 1974 was the petrodollar deal. And the petrodollar deal between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia was that the U.S. dollar became tied to oil. Thus, countries had to save U.S. dollars and use U.S. dollars to a certain extent in order to get oil. I believe one of the statements was that the U.S. dollar was as good as gold in that context. So the U.S. dollar is tied to and linked to oil, which, of course, is a major source of energy in this country, still one of the major sources of energy, despite this newer call for, green energy, windmills and biofuels and solar, for example. So the U.S. economy, I would argue, is still relevant and still powerful because of the petrodollar deal. If you look at what's going on in the global economy, the U.S. dollar has done pretty well. I don't know if it's decreased in recent days, but the U.S. dollar globally has done well in this crisis. And it's done well because, I would argue, its position as the petrodollar, the petrodollar, the fact that it's tied to oil, the fact that countries have to save up U.S. dollars. Now, what you're seeing to a certain extent outside of this, let me just digress a little bit here. My understanding is that China and Russia and some other countries are looking to trade in other currencies. So they're not using the U.S. dollar or trying not to use the U.S. dollar in order to trade goods among themselves. This is a move that some other countries have been trying to do and get away from the dollar. I know that Libya, when Muammar Gaddafi was the head of state in that country, was trying to use the gold dinar. I know that Iran was trying to set up some kind of separate oil bourse or some separate enclave that wouldn't use U.S. dollars. Of course, interestingly enough, Iran is one of the countries that's been hardest hit by the coronavirus. So if you look at the economy has changed the last 40 years. Getting to Casey's point about that this economy hasn't worked for years. It hasn't worked because I would argue, a little as what I argued in my previous interview, that we've gone from a productive economy where you had living wage jobs, manufacturing jobs, and jobs that allow people to buy homes and cars and put their kids through college, to a reductive economy where the wages are lower and the cost of living is higher. The economy has also changed. So it's gone from manufacturing to a more financially based economy, more dominance of banks, more dominance of Wall Street. Part of this was moves like the ending of the Glass-Steagall Act in 1999. You also see massive trade deals in the 90s like NAFTA. That's impacting the global scale, and globalization has been a major factor. But the economy globally and the economy in this country has been changed. And so I look at things economically by looking at those three factors. What's gone on with the corporate community in terms of the Lewis Powell memo in 1971, Nixon's taking the U.S. Off the Bretton Woods system also in 1971, and the petrodollar deal in 1974 that fixed the U.S. dollar to oil and made the U.S. the petrodollar and the sort of world reserve currency. So that has shaped the economy that we're in. Those three factors, I would argue, have shaped the economy that we're in.
Casey, you haven't spoken as much during this conversation, and I know that Albert and you have a very, very good rapport. So I want to give you a chance to ask a few questions to Albert. I'm going to just sort of lie back, lie low for a little bit here and let you two have a little short discussion.
So I'd be remiss to deny that this upswing in wildcat strikes and militant labor, however we may call that in the 2020s, has been kind of building, at least for the past 2 to 4 years. Like, I'm reminded of the teachers' strike in West Virginia and Arizona, California. There have been multiple strikes by service sector employees. Like, there are various Amazon strikes, various McDonald's strikes. Like, they never reach the scale that we're seeing now, but this has been like a slow burn. Like, a metaphor I'm thinking of in light of this upswing in labor militancy would be, initially, it was a stream pouring through a dam, and that gap in the dam is widening as this crisis goes on. So we really don't know what the next month or two are going to hold for whether this dam that we call neoliberalism will finally collapse or whether someone will come by and patch up the hole. Which do you think is the more likely between those two, considering there's a lot of historical inertia leading to this, as we've just talked about, these three main economic factors that form the bedrock of the modern American economy? What does that mean going forward then?
Well, as I mentioned before, the U.S. economy is engineered to fail the vast majority of people. It's what I called fiscal obsolescence, financial obsolescence, economic obsolescence. And much like planned obsolescence with any product, what they want are certain failures to occur. It's the way that the economic system is set up, the business cycle. You know, booms and busts. You have high times in regards to stock prices and bonds and so forth, and then low times. You have highs and lows. You have soaring push up, and then you have crashes. And so when you have an economy that's engineered to fail, that's got to be maintained. So my point would be that this financial obsolescence, this economic obsolescence, has to be structured to continue on in further perpetuity, if at all possible. Perhaps it can't be done forever, but it has. But they have to get the system to continue to move in the direction they want. So now they have this. So what I had mentioned in my previous interview was that the pattern is more than likely that you're going to have a bill and an act by Congress that that I can recall. There's going to be a response by lawmakers. There's going to be a response by politicians. And that's what we've had in the CARES Act. And there's probably going to be another CARES Act, this $2 trillion act. Just like in 2008, what you saw was a bailing out of the business community, the corporate class, and the economic sector. What you didn't see in 2008 was a bailing out of workers and employees. And so thus, the top 10% got bailed out, and the bottom 90% didn't. What's interesting, or really not that interesting, but predictable even about this particular year and this particular crisis, is how they just as I mentioned that this was a health crisis tethered to an economic crisis. What they've done is tethered supposed financial relief for the average American to real financial relief to the corporate and business sectors and financial sectors of this country. Thus, you have a so-called slush fund administered by the Secretary of the Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, $500 billion. Within that $500 billion, you have several billion dollars going to the airline industry. And of course, Boeing said they needed billions of dollars because they were losing money. But when it was announced that the government might take an equity stake in Boeing as a result of this, they said, oh, no. We don't need the money. We don't really need the money. So we see those corporate games that are going on. Say that you talk a good game, but in the reality, you'll take money even if you don't need it. So you're talking about several billion dollars going to the airline industry, but more than $400 billion in direct monies that can be administered to businesses that will be overseen by the Secretary of Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, someone I call Slumlord Steve, because he was well with properties prior to becoming Secretary of State, and thus giving the federal government, especially the Treasury Department, enormous power in this regard. This is a giveaway to the top financial sectors of this country in the billions of dollars, while the average American at best gets $1,200 per person if they get $1,200 per person. But they get $1,200. Thus, the average person gets crumbs. The corporate elite get the cake and the full course meal. And that's what we're seeing. So that was, in a sense, predictable, but in a sense, not as predictable that they would tether. So it was predictable that this pattern, because that was a pattern in 2008. It was bail out the corporations, bail out the financial sector. But they tethered it to Americans because of the severe nature of this economy. The fact that businesses shut down, jobs are gone, paychecks are vanishing, and people have to pay their rents, they have to pay their mortgages, they have to pay for food and other kinds of supplies. And so they tethered this, they literally tethered the bill. That's why they had this not separated. They could have separated into two different bills. No, they incorporated into one bill. So this is a corporate giveaway, as we normally see, but it's a corporate giveaway tethered to a supposed giveaway of money to millions of people, $1,200 per person. In a way, you know, again, this is indicative of the deception and the deviousness on the part of the elites, on a part of the ruling class, on a part of the corporate class. It's predictable, but it's also interesting to see how they did this.
On that, I would agree. And I think there's something to be said about, like, even though every American, at least theoretically, anywhere between now and 7 months from now, will get their $1,200 a month check or have it like forwarded to their tax returns next year. All that money that's supposed to be going into their pockets will just be, it'd be like you get your paycheck, you turn around and you give it to your landlord, your bank that has your mortgage. You're going to give it to your, you're going to be paying down debt pretty much. And that's all our economy really is when you get down to the nitty gritty, a debt economy. So nothing new is really being created. Like no new manufacturing, no. There's no expansion or reinvestment in capital. Even the bailouts of the working class, which, as we've already said, is just breadcrumbs, isn't even going to better the lives of the working class or in this sense or any point in the future. It's going to bail out our corporate overlords. It's going to bail out your landlord.
You know what? A real bailout for the people would look like a debt jubilee at this point.
Well,
yeah,
that's
but that's off the table
that
because
were...
that's the very foundation of our economy.
Well, see, that's why, you know, I had mentioned that before, that debt was a large part of the economy. We live in a debt-based economy. We also live in a consumerist economy, which is why we're having the problems we have with businesses and jobs and workers. They can't go and work in retail. They can't, in some respects, not all respects. They can't work in the food and beverage industry. They can't work in some of these other industries that are very labor-reliant and rely on customers. On a consumer base and rely on a customer base that aren't remote like Amazon, where you could just go to a website and click on and order something. And so what we're seeing when you talk about debt, the U.S. economy has become very debt-based. Not only such aspects as credit default swaps, but also collateralized loan obligations. Basically, this economy has become an engine to create debt and to sell debt off. Also, hitchhiking in regards to the larger economy, what we have is an economy that has become so consumer-based that people can't work because their jobs are reliant on working at a restaurant or working at a bar or working in a store that relies on customers. And so it's a matter of people with money coming in to spend their money in the larger economy. So if the businesses are closed, things are limited. That's why grocery stores are probably doing pretty well because people are going to buy food and supplies and get supplies there. That's why I'm sure gas stations are doing pretty well because people have to get gas. That's why Amazon's doing very well because people are ordering stuff from them because they can't leave their homes or can only leave their homes for limited activities like shopping or having exercise. We have this economy that's consumer-based, and that is being decimated and destroyed before our very eyes. In fact, I would argue that the so-called Trump economy, not just a low-wage, high-profit economy, but this economy that was really the core of it was the Trump tax cuts that allowed corporations like Amazon to pay virtually no money. Corporations like Amazon and Apple and others to pay zero taxes, basically, and to offshore their money in tax havens in other parts of the globe. What it's basically done, in a sense, is what libertarians talk about. Well, government shouldn't pick winners and losers. But what this economy has done is pick winners and losers. The winners are companies like Amazon. The losers are local stores, local restaurants, local bars, and a lot of other larger businesses. So we have winners and losers being chosen by the sort of deficient nature of the economy, by the crisis. And ultimately, government has picked winners and losers because they bailed out the financial sector. They bailed out huge corporations and companies like the airline industry. So they're picking winners, and they're allowing losers to basically fail and decay and be destroyed in this economy. And so we are in, as I mentioned, an economy of planned obsolescence, an economic obsolescence, a financially obsolescent economy. That's the kind of economy that we're in right now. And the results are devastating. The results are not only devastating to workers and employees, we're going to lose out anyway because they don't have jobs, but even small businesses. These people are going to get wiped out. some of these businesses that were around prior to this crisis will not be around after this crisis, whenever that occurs. And so we're seeing an economy that is the very nature of economic obsolescence, as I call it. It's engineered to fail. I mean, we're seeing this really before our very eyes. You can't deny it. I mean, there are people who will deny it, but you can't deny it. So it's gotten to such an extent that the only way to fight back, if you're in the bottom 90%, if you're an employee, is to go on strike. To go on strike if you work at Amazon and Whole Foods and Instacart and McDonald's, but also to go on strike if you're an average person and you can't pay the rent. To go on rent strikes like they did in Los Angeles, where they drove by the mayor's house and honked their horns. They did what they had to. It's almost like drive-by protesting. You know, maybe this will be a thing after this crisis occurs. The people, as they have in prior years in American history, whether it was the Lawrence, Massachusetts strike, whether it was the Haymarket, whether it was the Ludlow Massacre, and other kind, whether it was the general strike in Seattle in the earlier part of this century, they are rising up and they are demanding not only better for themselves. You know, someone like Ben Shapiro would say that these people are selfish, that these people are should be fired. In fact, he said that on one of his, I believe it was on his podcast. This is indicative of the old-fashioned right-wing views that were rife in the early part of the century, and to some extent still remain to this day. So someone like Ben Shapiro thinks, well, these workers have no right to strike because they're being paid a little bit more. In the case of Amazon, maybe $2 more an hour. But these people aren't striking for fun. They're striking because their lives are on the line. These are people that, as one employee supposedly said, they was a worker for Purdue, they noted, we are risking our lives for chicken. Just multiply that. We are risking our lives for shipping boxes and packages. We are risking our lives for packages. We are risking our lives to deliver these packages. We are risking our lives for Big Macs and French fries. We are risking our lives to pump gas. We are risking our lives to work because we're forced to work. But we're not given the tools and PPE in equipment, and we're not given the money that we deserve. And so they've had no choice but to strike. So this is not simply about aggrandizement. This is about survival. And that is what we're seeing. Working people doing the best they can to survive. And this is what's occurred. It's become this almost, I hate to say it, but it's become this almost Spencerian society.
Herbert Spencer. Social Darwinism. Yeah.
Survival of the fittest. So what we're seeing is not simply survival of the fittest. We're seeing survival of the financially fit and survival for the financially unfit. And it's also, in my view, for the right, becoming almost Malthusian. It's almost like the right has channeled Thomas Malthus, and that is what they believe. They are willing to sacrifice the working classes of this country. They are willing to sacrifice the poor in this country. They're willing to do that because they believe in the economy, but they do not believe in people, which is why the president wants to, quote, open up America. He doesn't see America as a country. He doesn't see America as a nation. He sees America as a business from sea to shining sea. As I used to say, one bank, you know, giving loans with checking accounts for all. This is the way that this administration sees America. It sees it as one gigantic business, and business is bad, and we need to get business up and running again. That's how they see it. That's the mindset. They don't see America as a nation state. They don't see America as a country that has citizens. They see America as a business that has customers, that has consumers.
I want to add something to that. We mentioned that Bill Hicks quote about third world consumer plantation. That's what the U.S. is becoming when he was saying it back in the 90s. And now we've sort of come full circle, and that sort of prophecy of Hicks has happened. I want to note, because I'm sure there's someone out there that is going to say, well, what about those third world countries that we have all exploited under this system of global capitalism? I don't want to say that we shouldn't care about what's been done to the third world either. It's interesting. I think what we're currently seeing happening is the exploitation we have seen of the third world for all these decades. Well, now the chickens are coming home to roost, and now even people within America are being thrown under the bus. The system has gone fully global, and people are being essentially sacrificed to this system to keep it going.
Excellent point. This dovetails perfectly with my first blog piece of the year, which I recently wrote, which I entitled Gun, Steel, Virus. What I write in my blog piece, which is on medium.com, is that what my assessment of this virus itself, and my historical assessment, is that this is a virus that is striking at the heart of the First World, to use the language of the Bandung Conference of the 50s. This is a virus that is upending historical trends. In the past, the Third World has been set up for failure. Just as I mentioned that the American economy is engineered to fail the vast majority of people, the 90%. What we see globally is the Third World has been engineered through empire and through imperialism to utterly and completely fail, to fail economically, to fail politically, to fail in socially and various other ways. And so what's happened is not only was there actual empire in regards to such countries as the British Empire, Germans, the French, even the Italian and Spanish, coming to parts of South America, to parts of sub-Saharan Africa, to parts of Asia, in limited respect. But what you see is that these parts of the Third World were left economically destitute, were left technologically destitute, were left politically and socially behind. And so this has opened it up to what I also call medical imperialism. You recently had two French doctors that were working on a vaccine for the coronavirus, or trying to work on something in regards to the coronavirus, that said they wanted to test their vaccine out on sub-Saharan Africans. And they used the example of a prostitute and saying that a prostitute is open to all kinds of possible diseases because they don't use protection. That is how the First World views the Third World. In those kinds of terms, like a prostitute, that they can have their way with the Third World. And so the Third World is born the brunt of what I call medical imperialism, born the brunt of diseases like Ebola in sub-Saharan Africa, and even in the developing Asian countries and some technologically advanced Asian countries like China, like South Korea and others. They had SARS, MERS, H1N1. What we're seeing is a reversal of this. And so what we're seeing with this coronavirus, COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2, however you call it, is this disease striking at the heart of former imperial powers, hitting Italy and destroying parts of Italy, Italy, the former home of the Roman Empire, destroying parts of Spain, Spanish Empire, having dramatic cases escalate in the UK, the home of the British Empire. And even the U.S., which has had a tiny empire, places like Guam and Puerto Rico and American Samoa, what we call American Samoa, part of the American empire. The U.S. has become the epicenter of this virus. So this virus is now striking the heart of the First World. The First World is now beginning to experience what the Third World has gone through for several years now, and even decades past. So that's what I note in my recent blog piece, that there's a reversal of historical fortune. It's almost like history has reversed course and decided now it is time for the former imperial powers, which not only brought guns, technology, and trinkets, and even diseases with them, which impacted populations in centuries past, not just the 19th century, but before that. Now we're seeing this reversal of fortune. that's striking at the heart of the first world. And so now the first world, countries like the US and the UK and Spain and Italy, are seeing the devastation of viruses, the devastation of diseases. And it says something about the nature of the first and the third world that a country like Cuba can send doctors to a supposedly wealthy nation, a first world nation like Italy, which has seen dozens of doctors die because of this virus. This tells you something about the historic nature of this virus, and I would say about the upending of empire, so to speak. Now the seat of empire is where this virus is striking. It's intriguing to me, and this has been my assessment. I think it's unexpected. I don't know that anybody or most people could have foreseen that Europe would be ground zero for this virus. It was initially China, and China did what it could. Well, it had the infrastructure to do what it could to fight this virus. You know, it had the fever clinics. It had its quarantine hotels. And they built hospitals, a couple of hospitals, over 1,000 beds each, in each of them less than 2 weeks. So China was kind of prepared for it, as was Taiwan and South Korea. And they've had dramatic success with this virus. But we're seeing a historical reversal. It's fascinating that the empires of old are now becoming the epicenter of this deadly virus. It's something I think that is unexpected. It's like history has decided to reverse course. And what struck the third world, or the kinds of contagions that had struck the third world, are now, the chickens are coming home to roost in the first world. And it's kind of a kind of judgment of history, so to speak, in a sense. And that's what it seems like to me.
Well, Albert Lanier, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. I think we gave a good overview and sort of update on the economic aspects of the coronavirus pandemic and crisis. If you could, let my listeners know how they can keep up with your work.
Right. Well, before I go, I just want to note one more thing, and then I'll let people know how to do it. There was a great interview. When we look at this virus, a great interview that was on CNBC recently. There was a CEO, a guy who had been involved with Facebook and some other companies, and he was interviewed. And he basically said during this interview, the host had said, well, do you want these airlines to fail and these companies to fail? And he said, yes. He said, why shouldn't they be wiped out? You know, it was sort of like the host was kind of incredulous. He couldn't believe that this guy, this capitalist, this CEO was admitting to this or stating this. And he said, and it was fascinating, he basically had brought out what I've been bringing out when I've been interviewed or when I've spoken on shows in terms of my assessment of the economy. What is there to protect? Hedge funds that service billionaires and millionaires? Who cares? You know, people who won't be able to summer in the Hamptons in New York? Who cares? Let them be wiped out. And so when we look at this economy, what we're seeing is that the top tiers of the economy, the top tiers of the business class, are being protected. They're getting billions of dollars in bailouts. And this is part of the protectionist nature of the state in regards to the top 10% and the top 1%. And so my attitude is, who cares about that? I don't. The protection needs to go to the bottom 90%. Because those are the people that will not get billions of dollars from the government. They'll get $1,200 and nothing more. They won't get jobs after this crisis. They won't be able to pay their rent. They won't be able to pay their bills. So why should we care about hedge funds? Why should we care about corporations like Amazon and Apple and all these other outfits? Why should they get bailed out? My response to that is, if they can't hack it, too bad. If you truly believe in capitalism, then if you're going to take the risks, then you have to suffer the consequences. The people who are taking the risks, the owners and investors, are not suffering the consequences, at least not in the top tier of the business world. They're not suffering the consequences. They're enjoying the rewards of protection. And so when it comes to this protection, I say, who cares? It should be the bottom 90 that get protected. The bottom 90% that get detected are protected, not the top 10%. So in regards to where people can find me, they can find me on Twitter at criticincorporated.com. They can find me on Facebook under my name, Albert Lanier. And they can find me, I'm sure they can find my interviews not only here on Parallax Views, but elsewhere.
Well, again, Albert Lanier, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views.
All right, thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with friend of the show at this point, regular guest almost, I would say, and just all around great veteran journalist, Albert Lanier. I think he always provides a perspective worth listening to, and I hope you feel the same way. Let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmail.com. And of course, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon. This show is my main source of income, so I really appreciate the help if and when you, the listener, can afford it. Posted some new content, including video interviews with Vinay Gupta, the original interview, as well as a bonus interview we did with Vinay, and a video version of our recent conversation with Grant M. Gallagher, the infectious disease journalist who joined us to talk for 2 hours about the COVID-19 pandemic. Also, I just posted a new edition of Parallax Views, The Week That Was. Very heavy on the pop culture talk, though, this time. A little bit of current events in there as well. We talked a great deal about China and COVID-19. So that was an extra long episode, actually. It was about 2 hours and 20 minutes, I believe. So we're making up for lost time, folks. I hope you will consider checking out what we are doing on the Parallax Views Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.